You're listening to Birth Babies
and Busy Moms.
I'm Kia.
And I'm Dana.
We're two busy, sleep-deprived moms discussing different stages of motherhood,
providing personal experiences and guest speakers to empower and educate mothers around the world,
helping and supporting them to make informed decisions and to let you know
you're not alone. I know. And welcome back to episode 4. And in this episode, Kia, you're going to love this. We have Dr. Carly King, who's a naturopath, that's going to come on and talk about all things pregnancy, birth, and postpartum.
Yeah, I'm honestly super excited about this episode. I love naturopathic doctors. I seen one after I had my second child, and I feel like that helped answer all the questions that I had that nobody was giving me an answer to.
Yeah, that's perfect. And I personally had never even heard of a naturopathic doctor before Kia had explained what it was to me. And I'm really excited to learn more about it from Dr. Carly King herself.
Yeah, so let's get into it. So welcome, Dr. Carly.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And we're excited to have you. So tell us a little bit about what a naturopath is and how you came to be one.
Yeah, so I am a licensed naturopathic doctor, and I think that's an important thing to distinguish. There's a lot of like terms about natural health practitioners and naturopaths, and a naturopathic doctor is a primary care provider. And so we have an undergraduate degree, and then we do a 4-year post-grad degree. And in Ontario here, we only have the one school in Toronto. So from there, we are entering into primary care. And so we do similar practice to, I would say, more of like a family practice or a GP, where we're doing intakes, we're doing lab work, we're doing physical exams and diagnostics assessment, as well as treatment plans. We have a little bit more of a holistic approach or comprehensive approach where we kind of look at the whole person. And so we're looking at physical aspects, and we're also looking at things like mental health aspects. We're looking at things like diet and lifestyle and what really makes the whole person in front of us an individual to meet their individual needs with individual treatment plans as well. And I got into this initially really at the end of my undergraduate degree. I wasn't really sure where I wanted to go. I knew I wanted to go into health, and I started getting really bad migraines. They were debilitating. I was throwing up for hours on end. I was missing school. I was having them 4 or 5 days a week, and no one could figure it out. I went to my GP. She opened her pharmaceutical cabinet and was like, here's all the meds. These are all the samples. None of them is going to fix this. All of them have side effects. Take a bunch, try and play around with them. And they ended up making me a lot more sick. I ended up seeking out a naturopathic doctor who helped identify some food sensitivities, some key nutrients that I was missing. And then we explored acupuncture, which honestly made such a huge difference in my life. It was that pivotal point for me where I was like, this is what I need to do. I want to find this like underlying root cause to really help people rather than just giving it that band-aid effect. And so that's how I came to be a naturopath.
So how did you get into women's care specifically?
Yeah, so I was always that person who loved babies. I was always babysitting all the babies in my neighborhood from a young age. I thought I wanted to be a pediatrician, actually, at one point. I started kind of gravitating towards that. And then when I became pregnant with my son for my first in 2015, I was like, this is it. I am niching into this. This is exactly what I want to do forever. And I really love that space. But I had a really, really difficult pregnancy and birth experience. And I didn't have great care. I didn't have great support from my medical team through that experience. And I was kind of just lost. Like, no one really knew how to help me. Even in the naturopathic space, like, there weren't people who were used to dealing with high risk pregnancy. My training was like, everyone has these beautiful, holistic pregnancies and home births, and nothing goes wrong. And that's very far from the truth for a lot of people. And so I can share a little bit about that. So initially, I conceived my son actually on my IUD. And so my husband at the time and I, we had gone on this California camping trip. We were like surfing and camping down the coast of California for 2 weeks. Got home, missed my period. I was like, oh, it's probably travel. It's fine. Started getting really sick and then took 6 pregnancy tests, was pregnant on my IUD, went to see my GP. She was like, oh my God, I've never seen this before. I don't know what to do. So she ended up sending me to a fertility clinic. And because we actually can use a copper IUD as a means to terminate a pregnancy, it's high risk to conceive on a copper IUD. And so I was followed by the fertility clinic for my first trimester. Already, it was like, we don't know if this is going to be a viable pregnancy. This is really high risk. There could be loss. So it was stressful. We didn't really want to tell people about it. And then my first prenatal blood work came back and it showed that I was in kidney failure out of the blue. And so now we like had this idea of having this home birth. We really wanted to have a home water birth. We had midwives already on our team. And then all of a sudden, I got shuttled over to high risk maternal fetal medicine. And every appointment was like, you're gonna die. Your baby's gonna die. Everything's really scary. You have to listen to us, or bad things are going to happen. Nobody wanted to answer questions for me. I wanted to be proactive. I was asking about things like diet and exercise, what I could do, what I couldn't do, if there were things that could help my kidney function, if there were things that I should be doing in addition to kind of standard of care. And nobody really wanted to give me answers. And I didn't feel like it was patient-centered care. I ended up getting to the end of that pregnancy with pretty consistent kidney function, and baby was doing great. But we got to 40 weeks, and 40 weeks, we kind of got to that tipping point where they were like, okay, baby's fully cooked. We want to induce you. Kidney function had dropped a little bit at the end. So we had decided, okay, that's fine. And with my midwives, we had asked for a Foley catheter, which at the time wasn't kind of the standard of care to do. Even though the research was there for it, as we know, standard of care guidelines can take up to a decade to really implicate or include the research. And so they ended up giving me a prostaglandin gel, which is it's a gel that they put right on the cervix that's supposed to dilate the cervix and push you into labor. They watch you at the hospital for 30 minutes, then they send you home. I got home. I was in labor for like 12 hours, but it was like not progressive labor and not typical labor. I'm trained as a birth doula too. I was like, this is not normal. My contractions started getting really intense, like 5 minutes long. Called the hospital. The nurse was like, have a bath, wash it out. I was like, this doesn't feel right to me. I'm coming in. And they started getting so intense. As soon as I got in the car, I could like see the outline of baby on my stomach. I was like, oh my gosh, we need to get there right now. Got to the hospital, ended up with an emergency cesarean. The second I walked in, baby's heart rate had dropped to 45 beats per minute. Pretty much everyone on the ward like was there instantly. My son was delivered within 8 minutes. He was born essentially still. He was blue when he came out. He wasn't crying. It was terrifying. They took him away from us and said, this baby's going to have brain damage. And we didn't get to see him for 12 hours. We ended up having a 2-week NICU stay with him. He had 2 collapsed lungs. It was later determined, not at that time, that he had had a stroke as well. We actually didn't identify that until he was starting to walk at 18 months and he started dragging his limb. Like nobody caught it. Nobody caught it afterwards. Nobody caught it at the time. We had no follow-up. It just was very poor care. Even leaving the hospital, the doctor that had resuscitated him had said, like, as we're leaving to a first-time mom, I can't believe that baby made it. And that was my last words from any hospital staff member. And I just remember leaving being like, is this how we treat new moms? Like, this is awful. And since then, I feel like I've just heard so many stories from other women who have gone through similar experiences. And everybody feels like it's only them. Like, it feels like it's just this thing that happens to a few people. It's a rare occurrence. And I actually don't think that's true. I think that it's a lot more common than we think that people go through these really traumatic experiences during such a vulnerable time where, like, you're going to remember what people said to you during that time for the rest of your life.
Yeah, well, firstly, I just want to start by saying I'm so sorry that happened to you. Like, that's something that nobody should have to go through. And I think that, as sad as it is, I don't think it's as rare as people think because, like you said, so many people think it's just me who went through it or just you who went through it. And I think that it's hard because you probably were in this bubble of no one can connect to me or understand me because no one's gone through it, right?
Yeah, and I think it was interesting because coming in from a medical background, I like knew a lot, but I also felt like I like got bullied into this decision with the induction that I didn't really want. And it was such a fear-based decision. And I really hate making decisions from fear. And like I knew the research, I knew what I really wanted to happen, and I still was in that position. And again, like being from a naturopathic background, I felt like there was a lot of bias around me in the hospital. They were like, oh, she's a naturopath. She's probably taking weird things. And I was like, no, guys, like this is from the gel you gave me. I didn't take anything. I know what I can and can't take in pregnancy. The treatment was really poor. I couldn't believe some of the things that were being said in the hospital. And for someone who doesn't have a medical background, I think it's even worse because you're just like so vulnerable to being told what to do. You don't necessarily know what questions to ask. You don't know what your choices are. And I feel like as a naturopathic doctor, that's really where my role comes in to help my patients understand, to educate them, to help them advocate for what they want and what makes the most sense to understand the risks and benefits. And usually, what happens is I've seen someone through maybe period problems or a PCOS or an endometriosis diagnosis or infertility. And so I've been working with them for a while. We've established a good relationship. We have that trust and that connection. And then we can walk them through a pregnancy and postpartum. So there's this continuity of care, which you don't really get with obstetric providers, right? Like you meet a midwife or an OB for the very first time at your first prenatal visit. Maybe it's a phone call. Maybe you don't even meet the OB until after 20 weeks. And then after that 6 weeks postpartum visit, it's like, see you never. And then there's no follow-up really.
Yeah, so when I delivered my first daughter, it wasn't the OB who had been following me because it's usually the OBs that are on call. This is in Alberta, so I'm not too sure how it works in Ontario. It's just the level of care, it's different among all providers as well. And you don't have a relationship with the individual who is birthing your child at that point. And a lot of issues arose for me because of that.
Yeah, so it's the same here. You kind of get whoever's on call, unless you have like an outside of the hospital team where you might have two doctors and you're kind of guaranteed to get one or the other. But if you're at the hospital, you're just there, you're going to see whoever. And so maybe you've never even met the person who's delivering your baby, right? And so there's no relationship, there's no trust. And it's funny, even as a naturopathic doctor, I'm not a prescriber, so I don't prescribe pharmaceuticals, but I'm trained to understand what they do, understand the reactions. And my patients will call me all the time and be like, should I take this? Like, no one explained this to me. And I don't know what it does. I don't know what the risks are. I don't know what the benefits are. And that informed consent for me is so, so important that people know exactly what the treatment is they're getting, whether it's a medication or whether it's an induction option during labor and delivery. Like, people need to understand what they're consenting to. And when they give you the paper to sign, right, before a C-section or whatever you're doing, it's just like this massive list of fine print and nobody's reading it. Like, nobody is reading it. When it's like, okay, here we go, we got to get into the operating room, you're just signing away and you're not aware of what the consequences potentially are.
And you're so vulnerable in that state too when you're signing the documents.
Absolutely.
The last thing you want to do is read the fine print when they're telling you, oh, you might die, or we need to get this baby out now, or there's an emergency.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, even I think some of the smaller things you don't necessarily even know, right? As a layperson, you're like, well, I'm gonna trust the doctors that they have the best interest for me and we're gonna do it. And so it is challenging, and it's challenging as a patient to even question things. That was absolutely my experience. Nobody wanted me to ask questions. I was like a difficult patient because I wanted to ask questions. I wanted to, and I wasn't trying to be difficult in any way. Just I had questions and I wanted to know what the options were. And they didn't like that. There was like a lot of ego around that. I found with the care providers in the hospital, they just didn't want to give me the time to go over the basics of informed consent, and that's concerning.
So when I gave birth to my daughter, forceps were used. I asked for a C-section and she said, "No, we're not going to give you one. We're going to put forceps in and pull the baby out." Well, she didn't tell me there was complications associated with this. And I feel like that's where the medical care is lacking, is the informed consent, exactly what you had said.
Yeah, it's scary, right? Like, there's a lot that can happen with a forceps delivery, and there's a lot of trauma potentially for both mom and baby there. And if you don't know what to expect, like, that's not a nice experience.
So let's get a little bit more into your pregnancy and your postpartum. Like, what was your effects of the delivery? What was your baby's effects of the delivery?
Yeah, so I actually felt pretty fortunate after that pregnancy. I remember like reflecting a lot on that afterwards, and I think initially I was just so happy that he was okay. He was able to come home. I mean, right after was really challenging in the NICU. We weren't able to breastfeed initially because of such a traumatic delivery. And so we had to pump and then tube feed through a nasal gastric tube. He had the CPAP on because of his lungs and he was in the incubator. And so, I mean, the NICU is a whole nother world when you're in there, and it's super stressful and people don't get it. Like, we had like extended family members. We don't even really talk to that often, who are like, we want to come to the hospital. And I was like, oh my gosh, no, it's the middle of winter. My son has two collapsed lungs. Like, we are not bringing a ton of people here. We just need to manage this right now. And so there was like a little bit of a bubble for a bit, which was nice, but I had really good support. And I think that really makes such a huge difference afterwards, that I had the support. I had people who were willing to come and help or bring us food or whatever we needed. And not everybody has that. And that's such a huge risk factor for postpartum mental health challenges. I was really lucky that when I was able to breastfeed, it was easy. I was like, yes, something that is easy. Like, we had this terrible pregnancy, we had this terrible delivery, but breastfeeding went really well. And that felt like such a win at the time. I took 6 months off because I'm self-employed, and that felt like such a blissful time too. My husband at the time had paternity leave, so he was off for 4 months, and it just felt like we had that really nice time together. And so I like felt like I was like watching. I was like waiting to see what would happen with my mental health and postpartum. I had so many risk factors there with the traumatic delivery and the emergent delivery and the health complications with my son. And it didn't happen. And I was kind of surprised by it, but I think I also was really aware of it and doing things that I was able to control to help support that. So getting out and getting outside and exercising. I was walking daily with my son, really trying to focus on nourishing foods, making sure all my blood work was in line, getting support from family and friends, prioritizing sleep, like doing the things that I could to really support them. And my son was great. Like, he's turning 9 next month, which is wild to me, but he was such a great baby. He was so relaxed, and that made a huge difference, I think, too. We didn't notice anything. There was no follow-up for him, like zero. I had taken him to the GP and I had taken him to another ND, and I was like always watching because I was like, this was such a traumatic delivery. Like, They did a brain ultrasound. They're not super accurate early on. We didn't do an MRI at the time because he was so young. But I was always watching. I was like watching for, I always do this. My background's in kinesiology. So I'm always looking at like muscles and movement patterns. And he was delayed in walking. And so at 18 months, he was starting to walk finally, but he was dragging his right leg as he was walking. And initially, I thought it was from his hip. So we started him in physio, we started him in vision therapy. We did all the things really early. And eventually, I didn't actually get in to see a developmental pediatrician until he was almost three with the wait times. And I was like, ah, he's got a positive Babinski reflex on the bottom of his foot, which means it doesn't flex the way that it should. And I was like, I'm pretty sure that he has nerve damage here. I think he might have had a stroke in utero. And she was like, yep, I agree. What do you want from me? I was like, well, I really just want a formal diagnosis because I don't know how this is going to show up for him, if he's going to need additional medical care, if he's going to need some sort of support once he gets into school age, that if it's right-sided, like he's got some challenges with his right hand. So I don't know what this will look like for writing for him. I don't know what this will look like down the road. And she saw us once and then dropped us. And then we never had follow-up care either. And so really it was up to me. This is how I like went down the rabbit hole of neurodevelopment and child brain development and what we can do even preventatively, because then I went on to have a second with my daughter 2 years later. And I was like, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that this doesn't happen again, which went pretty well. We made it to 34 weeks with her. And then my kidney function dropped again. And what had happened was my potassium level went up really high, which is a risk for essentially your heart stopping. And so I went in for like a routine prenatal visit at the hospital. And they're like, yeah, we're admitting you today. We're delivering. And so we ended up delivering early again. It ended up being an emergency C because they had given me some medication that made me really, really sick. And my blood pressure was skyrocketing. They couldn't tell if it was preeclampsia. And so with preeclampsia, there's two things we watch for. We watch for high blood pressure and we watch for protein in the urine. With kidney disease patients, the problem is that you always leak protein and your blood pressure is always high. And so it's hard to tell whether or not we're seeing preeclampsia. We have to start watching for other organ symptoms potentially, which aren't always there. But I did end up having some elevation in my liver enzymes. I was in the ICU after that for about a week. She was in the NICU again for about 2 weeks, but was fine. She's like the feistiest little 6-year-old now. And so we did great out of that pregnancy as well. She was a lot more of a high needs baby, but again, I was like ready for it. I was like, I'm doing all the things, I'm putting all the supports in place. And I feel very fortunate. But even looking back on that, I think I was like, oh God, like not every mom gets this, right? Like, not every mom has family around, not every mom has a partner, not every mom has the supports in place or the knowledge to help support themselves or have others supporting them through this time period. And so what are we doing for these moms? And like the answer is really not much.
The follow-up care for your daughter, was it a lot different than with your son?
No, we like had no follow-up with her either. No, there was really nothing. Like once we left the hospital, I actually ended up self-discharging. I was so disappointed in my care with her delivery. In the ICU, I was there for like 4 days and didn't see a doctor the whole time I was in the ICU. I delivered here in Hamilton. It's a teaching hospital. And so they have a lot of residents coming in. And I can tell they're like reading from the textbook. They're like, one was like screening me for like thyroid problems. And I was like, I don't have that. And they were trying to put me on Medicaid, like blood pressure medications that were contraindicated that would put my potassium up. I was like, I can't be on that one. Try again. It just was like such a disaster. I was laughing. There were just, even I had one resident, he like couldn't even come in the room because I was breastfeeding. He was so awkward about it. I'm like, oh my gosh, like if you weren't going to work in this perinatal space, you're gonna have to get used to women breastfeeding their babies. Like you can come in and have a conversation with me, your doctor. Like it's a body. You're going to have to figure this out.
Well, being from Hamilton as well, I had so many issues with the resident doctors. I honestly had in my birth plan for my second, no residents in the room. And of course, a resident delivered my baby. The resident delivered the placenta. Like they always keep pushing on you. This is a teaching hospital. This is a teaching hospital. And although my OB agreed with me, no residents in the room, the OB that was there allowed it. So I think there's just a huge mistrust with patients and providers, especially when it's with residents. And I understand it is a teaching hospital and that's how they do learn, but it must have been frustrating coming from a medical background yourself and knowing these things, whereas these residents are trying to put that on you, right?
Yeah, it was interesting. Like I could tell they like hadn't read my chart because they didn't know what was going on. And so I just kept being like, no, like you have to go back to your supervisor and like understand what this case is about because it is a high risk case. And I was followed by internal medicine. I was followed by nephrology. I was followed by a whole team, but there didn't seem to be a lot of communication within that. And it was even my medical records, like leaving it said I was like, there was like a checklist. It was like smokes a pack a day. Like, I was like, what? I was like, this is the wrong patient. Like, I don't think you have the right chart even. I don't know what's going on here, but this is not my chart. There were just a lot of mistakes. It was a really frustrating experience. And it's interesting because I'm actually 7 weeks out now from a kidney transplant. And so I just went through this experience. I just got it. My friend gave me a live kidney and the experience was so incredible. Like, it was the best healthcare experience of my entire life. I had it done at St. Joe's in Hamilton, and the whole team was amazing. The doctors were amazing. The nurses were amazing. The pharmacist was amazing. There was this collaborative approach, and the patient-centered care was so different from what I had experienced with the obstetric care. And it's interesting. There's so many similarities because I have this like huge incision down my side now, which is so similar to a C, it like crosses my C-section incision. And the recovery post surgery is very similar in that you have to like learn how to walk again and get up and moving. And the recovery process is similar in a lot of ways, except for you don't have to also care for a newborn human. So in some ways, I think it's actually easier. But the experience was so different for me. And I was like, oh, like, why don't we do this for new moms? Like, I had a physiotherapy team. Like, why didn't I have that after a C-section? They were just like, walk down to the NICU every 2 hours to breastfeed. And nobody told me how to do that properly or support my incision or how to breathe properly. And I had all of that support after this surgery. And it was really interesting to see the difference around that.
Well, I think too, though, that when you go through having a baby, you have so many different changes. It should be like an approach from all different types of fields. Like it shouldn't just be OBs. It shouldn't just be one provider that's going to say bye to you in 6 weeks, especially if you don't have any issues. They're just like, all right, see ya. Like for me, I was on as a patient for 1 year. I don't know if that's standard or not, but even when I tried to go back after 6 months later, it was, oh no, go to your family doctor. My family doctor isn't the one that specializes in this, but then his thing is, well, why wouldn't you be going back to your OB? Because that's where you should be. This is an obstetrics point of view or a gynecological point of view. And I think that there should be like a whole team of people opposed to just one provider, right?
Totally. I 100% agree. And that's also where I also come in a lot of the time is connecting people to other resources in the community that are going to be helpful. And so whether that's a pelvic floor physiotherapist, or whether that is a psychotherapist or another maternal mental health resource that is really essential in that period. Even things like postpartum doulas, when people just need that extra support in caring for themselves or caring for baby, there's so many resources. But as a new parent, you don't know where to look. No one's telling you what you should be thinking about during this time frame. And there's such an emphasis right on this like labor and delivery. And then we kind of forget about postpartum. It's like this fuzzy, nebulous kind of thing that exists, but we don't really think about it until we're in the middle of it. And then you're sleep deprived and you're trying to figure out how to care for this little human, and you're trying to figure out your new body and how to care for what's going on in your body still after a delivery. And it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming to try and figure that out yourself. And so you do absolutely need a support team.
So when patients come to you, let's say 6 weeks postpartum, what are the things that you're going to be screening for? What are the things that you're going to be requesting for lab-wise?
Yeah, and so I have a really comprehensive intake for people. And so usually if people are coming in, they're either a current patient, I've seen them through a whole pregnancy, so I know their story, or sometimes I do see people newly postpartum who just either don't have a GP to go to, and so they use me as primary care, or they just haven't found the support that they need through the rest of their medical team. And so they're looking for a more thorough approach. And so the first thing I ask about is, what was the pregnancy and the delivery like? Were you iron deficient at any point in your pregnancy? If you were, the standard of care is actually to retest iron at 6 weeks, but it almost never gets done because the people who were checking it during were either the OBs or the midwives. If you never see your OB after your delivery, you have to hope that the GP will ask about it, but often they don't. Midwives sometimes will run it, but sometimes not. And so people end up just stopping their iron pills, and iron deficiency is massively linked to postpartum depression. And so again, you're losing blood in a delivery, whether it's a vaginal delivery or a cesarean delivery. You're losing blood. You're going to lose iron in that blood. And so you end up being lower. But what we see is that the symptoms of iron deficiency also look like postpartum symptoms. You're tired. You're losing hair. Maybe your mood's a little bit low. Maybe your sleep is affected. And we don't necessarily make the connection. Again, as a new parent, like you're not making the connection. You're hoping someone's watching you. But that's definitely what I'm looking at. The other one I typically will be screening for is thyroid problems postpartum. And so we have really high statistics on this. We can see that 1 in 6 women potentially have an undiagnosed thyroid condition in postpartum. And again, symptoms are very similar to what we typically will see in postpartum: fatigue, maybe some joint pain, hair loss, maybe feeling with differences in body temperature. And so mood as well, absolutely, with thyroid disorders. And so screening for that, especially if there is a prior history of any sort of thyroid disorder, there's a family history, absolutely. If there's any sort of autoimmune thyroid disorder, such as Hashimoto's, there's very likely going to be really big swings up and down postpartum. That's a massive one with regards to mood. And so we definitely want to check in on that. And I'll say around this, one of the big things I see too is for fertility patients. A lot of fertility patients will be put on artificial T4 or Synthroid or levothyroxine for conception purposes, because we know that you're more likely to conceive if we have a narrower window for that number going into a pregnancy. So they stay on it through their pregnancy, they're watched through the pregnancy, and then afterwards they just stop taking it, or their provider tells them to stop taking it because they never had a thyroid problem. They just use it for fertility. And then all of a sudden, their thyroid swings way up. And so TSH is the number we're looking at here, and it should be between 0.4 and 4 for fertility purposes. Usually we like it lower, like under 2.5. This happens so often. I cannot even tell you. I had a woman I saw through fertility. She conceived via IUI. She was put on this artificial T4 and she stopped taking it after. They were like, just stop it. You never really needed it. I saw her, I think 8 weeks postpartum, and she was a wreck. She was in tears during the whole visit. Her mood was so bad. She was struggling so badly. She was like, I'm gaining weight. I can't even tell you. I didn't even gain that much weight in my pregnancy. And now I'm like up 60 pounds. My hair is falling out. I'm crying all day long. I was like, what's going on with the thyroid? Has anyone checked it? And we sent her for testing. And that TSH that is supposed to be under 4 was something like 180. It was like one of the highest numbers I've seen. I was like, oh my gosh, like, this is why you were struggling so badly. And everyone was just telling her, oh, that's normal. It's postpartum, which is awful.
It's frustrating too when you know something's wrong inside and you're letting other people tell you that it's not because you are so vulnerable in that period to begin with, right?
Totally. And I think that's such a huge point to make too. We see this in the research, like women know what's going on with their bodies. Women know what's going on with their children's bodies. For a doctor to think that they know better than a patient who has lived in their body every day of their life and is in that body all day long. For most doctor's appointments, you get like 7 minutes. And so how do you even screen during that time frame? Again, when we're looking at that piece, my visits typically are anywhere from 30 to 75 minutes. And so we have a lot more time to talk. We have a lot more time to really dive a little bit deeper. And we know that we get better diagnoses if we have more time with people and we allow them to tell their story and we allow them to share their symptoms and catch these things. The other big one I run up for a lot of people, if I haven't seen it at the postpartum visit, if I haven't seen it through pregnancy or we haven't watched it for a little while, is vitamin D. It's a really big one as well, especially for mood, for fatigue, for sleep, for joint pain, any autoimmune stuff going on. That's a really important one and a really underappreciated nutrient as well, especially at this time of year in Canada where we don't have sun. Everybody is deficient and sometimes it's off the charts and usually postpartum, there's a lot of depletions. And so we can see iron's low, we can see vitamin D's low, we can see B12 is low. And these things make a really big difference if we can get them up to a level where they're well supported and people can start to feel better fairly quickly with some of these changes as well.
And when you have these findings of these deficiencies, what are your recommendations moving forward for them?
Yeah. And so for depending on what's going on, so for things like iron and vitamin D and B12, we can supplement with those things. Depending on the situation with the iron, if people have been iron deficient for a long time, or if they're really struggling to take oral iron because of the digestive side effects, or if we're just like not moving the needle quick enough, I'm also a really big advocate for trying to get an iron infusion and do an IV. It's not within my scope of practice. So this is where the advocacy piece comes in. I'm usually writing over to their GP if they're still under the care of an OB, maybe the OB and requesting and just, I sent a whole letter over with all of the literature references on why we need to do this, explain what's going on with their mood. I'm always screening for mood with an objective tool. So we have that number to share with other healthcare providers. And 99% of the time we get it when we ask for that as well. Once we kind of like take care of those big things, we start to chip away at some of the smaller things. And so things like working on getting three meals a day in, if we can. Like, I don't even really care what people are eating at the very beginning. We eat what we can. It's really hard, right? When you have a newborn, if you don't have the support for people bringing you food or cooking, we're not expecting that diet is going to be perfect by any means. We're not taking foods out of the diet. We are supporting moms just trying to get nourished. So getting things like that in, trying to get outside for like 5, 10 minutes for a walk around the block. The research around exercise in postpartum is so huge, and pregnancy really improves all outcomes across the board. Massive for mood. Getting outside is bonus points because we get some sun exposure, especially early in the morning. This can help with mood. This can help with energy. This can help with sleep. And supporting that too, like if there's challenges with things like pelvic health or incontinence issues, connecting people with healthcare providers that can help with that, connecting with pelvic floor physios that can help with that piece there as well. Really just talking through what the most relevant things are and what people need the most support with.
Yeah, and I think too that a lot of women don't know about all these things. A lot of women just think instantly it's postpartum depression, it's postpartum anxiety. And while those things are very real, with my second, I thought that I actually had postpartum depression because everyone in my life was telling me so. And it wasn't until I seen a psychotherapist that said, until all of your physical symptoms have been dealt with, like all of your deficiencies, all of your medical labs need to come up to a specific point where now we can start looking at is this a psychiatric part or is this actually still physical? And I think that once women start realizing that and get the supports, like even pelvic floor therapy and the psycho aspect of it, like there's so much connections there. And I think so many women, especially OBs and GPs, for example, are just like, no, you have anxiety, go to a group or do something like that instead of like looking at it from a whole approach, which is so important postpartum. Like it's a game changer, I think.
Yeah, and I would agree with that too. I see this a lot where people just like get a pill, they get medication and no other resources or support. And absolutely, sometimes we do need that medication, but it's not a solution for people, right? Like you need other supports in place. And sometimes that's the thing that we need to be able to implement some of the other strategies. But if we're not addressing blood work, like I almost never see blood work done in postpartum for mood. And I think that's such a huge gap for what we need to be addressing in this area because the research is very clear around this. But I again, if you're not looking at the research all the time, then it's hard to keep up with it as a GP, right? Like you have to know everything. And so you're not an expert in pregnancy or postpartum, and it's challenging. And this is really why I decided to niche because I want to know every possible thing about this area. And I'm a nutrition professor too. I teach at McMaster. And so I look at this stuff all the time and I look at how impactful some of these things can be, even in making some of the medications that we use for depression in pregnancy or postpartum work better if we support some of these medications with getting things like omega-3s up and getting our vitamin D up. It actually can make some of these medications work even more effectively. And so there's lots that we can do with these integrative strategies that support a patient from multiple aspects.
When I had my second daughter, my midwife did the blood work and noticed that I was deficient in B12. So what we did is I had injections, and when I had those injections, I did not realize how much my mood was affected by my deficiency in B12. My mood just significantly improved.
Yeah, it's a serotonin precursor. And so it makes a lot of sense when we look at those pathways. And then B12 is a serotonin precursor, but then serotonin also converts over to melatonin. And so melatonin is a sleep hormone, which is also massively connected with depression and pregnancy and postpartum. And so if we're not getting enough of a nutrient like B12, our mood's going to suffer, our energy is going to suffer, and then our sleep's going to suffer. And so, how do you come back from that if we don't fix that underlying root deficiency?
So, do you think that the gap between women not getting enough testing is because of advocacy, the doctors just not having the time, resources? Like, what do you think is the gap?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. There's so many aspects to this, I think, in healthcare. I think that funding is a huge issue. And so we took vitamin D testing out of OHIP funding because it's too expensive. It's $39. It's not that expensive, but if we do it for everybody, it becomes more of an expensive test. Even though all of the research says like we should test every single pregnant person for vitamin D because it's associated with preterm birth risk, gestational diabetes risk, blood pressure issues, brain development and language development for the infant, and mental health for mom. But we don't because it's too expensive. The other aspect, I think, is time. Like, we don't have time in the conventional side to walk through all of these different aspects with the individual in front of us, especially we get 5, 7 minutes, and it's hard to capture all of what we need during that time frame. Iron is like pretty standardized for testing, although this is interesting too. There's actually a test. There's a study that was done out of St. Joe's in Hamilton looking at iron testing and who actually gets it in pregnancy and what the follow-up is. And don't quote me on this because I can't remember the specific numbers, but you're supposed to get at your first prenatal visit and then you're supposed to get it checked again at 28 weeks. And like a very high number of people didn't end up getting the second test. And for those that were found to be deficient at their first test, most of them weren't treated adequately and were still deficient if they did have the second test done. And so there's just kind of this lack of, I guess, lack of following up, but lack of really the importance of understanding what the nutrients do. And nutrition isn't taught in medical schools. And so even I teach for Hamilton or for health sciences. So they're like fourth year undergraduate students. Most of them are going into medicine. And it's the first exposure they've ever had to nutrition, which they're like everything blows their mind. It's such a fun class, but it's so great to be able to like share some of that information with future healthcare providers so that they understand some of the connections. And of course, I'm always doing a pregnancy module with them and talking about the maternal mental health aspect. Because I think it's so important, but this is what happens. There's just really big gaps. And for OBs or midwives, like their priority is making sure that baby is safe and gets delivered. And so that's the priority. We take care of the really big things in a pregnancy. We make sure baby gets here safely. And then mom's kind of like the afterthought, right? Like it's like everything is focused on baby, even with the postpartum visits. It's like we do the baby well child checks, but like, where's mom's well child or well mother check, right? Like, where is that? It doesn't happen.
And I think medicine is very reactive instead of preventative, which it sounds like a naturopath is more preventative, which is so important to do these measures before you end up in the hospital doing reactive measures, if that makes sense.
Totally. And this is like such a great aspect of naturopathic medicine is we can fill in the gaps with that preventative medicine piece. And especially now when OBs are seeing people at like 20 weeks for their first prenatal visit, it's too late because if we look at the research for anything, you have to intervene early in the first trimester at around 16 weeks. We have these spiral arteries in the uterus that transform. And so these arteries actually dilate and connect over to the placenta to get blood flow and nutrients over. And there's key nutrients like vitamin D and iron and calcium that need to be there to make this happen. And if it doesn't happen, you get smaller arteries, you get less blood flow, you get poor placental health, which can lead to so many negative outcomes in a pregnancy. But if we're not seeing some until 20 weeks, like it's too late. We can't intervene. And we have studies showing that if we intervene later, we actually don't see change. And so we do have this opportunity really early to make these changes. Same with iron deficiency. We know, like, if we can do this preconception, we get better results because what happens with iron in the first trimester really will predict the trajectory of what iron's going to do through the remainder of the pregnancy.
So when you have iron deficiency during pregnancy, does that mean your baby's at risk for iron deficiency? Like, what are the outcomes postpartum, let's say?
Yeah, hugely. I like love this topic so much. I love this topic with regards to maternal mental health, but also with baby's brain development as well. And so what we see is that most postpartum depression actually starts as antenatal or during pregnancy depression, and iron deficiency is massively relevant here for mom. Iron carries oxygen to your tissues, and so if your brain's not getting enough oxygen, doesn't feel good. It also helps make some of our key neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine, which are feel-good neurotransmitters, and so we need those pieces there. But what we also can see is that if there's windows during pregnancy where iron deficiency is present, it actually changes the brain structure of baby. And so we see permanent structural deficits if mom is deficient in iron for baby, which predisposes baby to depression and anxiety, even if we follow them in adulthood. It predisposes baby to things like ADHD with that brain development. And so it's really, really important that we look at this from a preventative aspect before we get into that place. Postnatally, we will see that children born to mothers who are iron deficient are more likely to be iron deficient as well, because we don't get all of that iron across to baby, especially if they're preterm. Most of the iron that baby gets is in the third trimester. And so like my daughter, born 34 weeks, she was like, my ferritin was like 5 during her pregnancy. We had to do infusions for that pregnancy, and she was like a really high risk baby. But in Canada, we don't test infants for iron deficiency. And so what usually ends up happening is sometimes I see moms like 5 years postpartum, or you see their kids or both 5 or 6 years postpartum, and they're both massively iron deficient still. And they're like, oh yeah, I was iron deficient in pregnancy, but no one ever checked me afterwards. And yeah, I am still totally exhausted, and I'm still losing hair, and I'm still having all of these issues. And my child's really tired too. And they always have these like dark circles under their eyes, and they're not sleeping. Like, they're up all night still. They're 5 and they're still getting up so frequently. These are all iron deficient symptoms. And so sometimes we do have to play catch up later on, but it's very, very common. It's the most common nutritional deficiency in the world.
So that's the one thing I wanted to kind of touch base on. So I had very low iron with both of my pregnancies. Of course, the first time they did it, no follow-up, no iron infusions. And my son had low iron. Like, his was at, I think, 2 or 3. And they tested it only at 1 year because he had so many issues, never slept longer than 2 hours. At what age do they recommend that you really should be pushing your doctor to test for if you do see these signs? And how does it get resolved? Do they get iron infusions? Do they just take supplements? Do they just change diet? Like, what is it from a natural doctor point of view?
Yeah, so there's not necessarily like an age recommendation. If there's symptoms present, we can check for iron anytime. I try not to like overly send kids for blood work if we don't need to, but there's some like easy tricks around that too. Like, you can use the Emla patches or cream, which is like a lidocaine like numbing cream before they go in. I have a local lab, and like, they have a fantastic tech with the little one. So I'm like, go see him. He's great. He'll get them done. They use a little butterfly in and out, like bring treats for afterwards. So really any age is fine. With the little guys, usually we are using supplements. We're not using infusions for kids typically. And so we have to find one that's easily absorbed. It's not going to cause digestive issues for them. But once iron deficiency is present, we do need to supplement. It's next to impossible to get it up with diet alone at that point. And especially with kids, especially with toddlers, like, they're picky eaters, right? And so trying to get really like iron rich foods in. We try to do that for sure with infant food introduction. And so I often will recommend using liver as a first food for infants, regardless of whether they were their moms were iron deficient in pregnancy, because we do need to start that at 6 months when iron needs go up. So we're always trying to prioritize those foods where we can and being sneaky about where we put some of these foods sometimes as well. But there's lots of ways that we can do that. With the supplements, there's liquid versions for kids that are usually pretty well tolerated.
And how long would you say if you do it daily for X amount of time, what time frame should a parent be looking at, let's say?
Yeah, so generally we do want to retest 3 or 4 months afterwards, and so that's kind of the time frame where your red blood cells that carry iron regenerate, and so we never test really before that. Except for in pregnancy, the rules are a little bit different. Technically, in pregnancy, we should be retesting 2 weeks after starting iron and looking at the hemoglobin and making sure it's moving. If it's not, we should be trying a secondary form. If it's still not, we probably actually need to consider infusions if the numbers are low enough, especially if anemia is present. If anemia is present and that hemoglobin has been affected, that's like an end stage form of iron deficiency. And so it becomes really challenging to catch up, especially in the third trimester. The risk of low iron in pregnancy for mom then is this hemorrhage risk. If iron deficiency is present, especially with anemia, your blood actually has to thin to distribute iron. And so the risk of hemorrhage is high if anemia is present in the third trimester. I really try and advocate at that point for iron infusions to make sure that, again, we're being proactive, we're being preventative, because like hemorrhage during a delivery is very traumatic. And then we're also risking needing a blood transfusion at that point.
Yeah, and then the list just keeps going, right? So the other thing I wanted to ask, so all these deficiencies, is it similar to how iron is for babies? Like if mom's vitamin D deficient, B12 deficient during pregnancy, is that most likely that baby will be too postpartum?
Yeah, so it depends on what's going on. And so if mom is breastfeeding, then we can actually supplement through mom, which is great. With babies, usually we're giving them a 400 IU version of vitamin D regardless. We use the baby D drops. All babies are going to be deficient. We're not suntanning them, and so they're all deficient. If babies are using formula, they're supplemented with these nutrients. And so I know this is like such a tough conversation, especially when moms are like really, really excited about breastfeeding. They really hope for that as their choice of feeding method. But like formula has some really nice positives to it too, because you do get the iron, you do get the B12, you do get the vitamin D there. And so sometimes that's a really nice supplemental option as well. So there's a couple different ways that we can look at doing that. The iron and the D are big. B12 is not a super common deficiency. Usually, we'll see that more commonly in patients that have plant-based diets, especially vegan diets. That's an absolute essential for supplementing there. Or like major digestive issues, we'll see that too. Anyone with things like newly diagnosed or like not well managed celiac disease, Crohn's, colitis, you're definitely going to see that these are some riskier areas for that vitamin B12 deficiency as well.
And then getting all this testing, is this covered by insurance or is this out of pocket?
Yeah, so typically most of the blood work that I run is covered under extended healthcare benefits. So people either have like a lab coverage or they put it through their naturopathic coverage. It's not very often that people end up having to pay out of pocket. Although I will say I do have a lot of patients that do pay out of pocket for services as well. It really kind of depends on the situation, but most people do have coverage there. It's not OHIP covered under naturopathic doctors, and so sometimes the other option for people is that we collaborate with their medical doctor, their GP, and we have that conversation with them as well. And we can write a letter over and just say, this is what's going on. We don't ask for like a huge list of things. We really just ask for the most relevant things. And I have a lot of GPs that are really willing to work with me because they know that this is my niche. They know that I'm an evidence-based naturopathic doctor, and they're happy to have that collaboration. It's when we ask for like too many things that gets like a little bit of stepping on toes there, or things that are not necessarily essential. We want to make really good, rational reasons for why we would want to run something.
And you mentioned that you're evidence-based. Where's this evidence coming from?
Yeah, so I am a professor and a researcher, and so I look at PubMed. I'm looking at medical journals, and I teach other naturopathic doctors and clinicians how to do this as well. And so I run a fellowship where I do this, and I teach to 700 clinicians on how to interpret and use critical appraisal, because not all research is good research, and so we want to understand how to interpret that research correctly. And where we want to pull from that research for clinical practice, and where we can kind of leave it behind. And so, this is where it's really easy to collaborate with other healthcare practitioners who are also evidence-based and looking at this information.
So, before we start wrapping things up, I want to see if we've touched everything that you want to talk about.
Yeah, I feel like we touched on a lot of things across the board. I don't know that I necessarily have a lot more to add. I can definitely give you some resources for your show notes around some mental health resources as well. One that's a great tool for people to have available to them for some of those like postpartum or even like during pregnancy, where you're not sure what's going on with mood and you're not really sure if maybe it's something that needs to be addressed or not. I hear this a lot from people postpartum where it's like, I don't know if this is depression. I don't know if this is something that I should be addressing. And there's a really great objective screening tool that it's actually it's well validated in the research. We just updated our perinatal care guidelines, our standard of care guidelines in Canada to include it. I'm not seeing it well used yet, but it's one I've been using for a really long time. And people can actually just, it's like 10 questions. You just check the boxes and it will give you a score. It's called the Edinburgh Postpartum Depression Scale. It's being validated for pregnancy too. And so people can fill this out and it will give you this number and it will tell you whether you're at risk, if you should seek some follow-up or not. This is a great one. I use this through pregnancy and postpartum, and it's nice to track that number and just see if it's getting higher and we have some concerns around this. There's a great website where you can just plug your answers in and it will give you the score. And so we can attach that in the show notes for people to have as well.
And that's a great resource, especially if people don't have the means to go see a psychologist or a social worker, or they just, had a baby, they don't have time to do it, but they could just go online, fill out this quick questionnaire screen, and just see if they need further evaluation.
Absolutely. And there are actually a lot of free online resources for maternal mental health. There's lots of great hotlines. I'll send some over so that there are some options available for people that may not have extended care benefits or even the access to get out of the house to go see a therapist, right? So there's some great online options or phone options available as well.
And then one thing for a naturopath as well, do you do virtual appointments if the mom's not able to leave their house?
Yeah, so I do a lot of virtual appointments with new moms. And so my license extends across Ontario. I get a lot of referrals from colleagues, especially with higher risk pregnancies or postpartum, where they just know that it's not their niche. And so they send people to me. I get a lot of referrals from therapists or pelvic floor therapists as well that we can all collaborate on. And so that's a really nice way to connect with people as well.
Especially when you just have a baby, sometimes you just don't have the means to leave the house, or you're going through something traumatic and you're bedridden, you're not doing very well mentally, physically. So this is just a wonderful option to have and for our listeners to know is available.
Totally. It's hard, right? And sometimes you just don't want to leave the house when you're still bleeding and you're leaking and you're just not feeling up to it. It's a really nice option. And the virtual has been it's been a really great option for a lot of new moms.
Well, thank you for coming on today. We really appreciate you sharing all of your knowledge, your story, and kind of connecting with us. And we'll add everything in for the listeners. We'll add your information as well. Maybe people want to connect with you, kind of have more of like a personal approach from your perspective.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on the show. This was a great conversation, and I really appreciate what you two are doing, just having these difficult conversations and normalizing that birth and pregnancy and postpartum experience that more people can relate to.
Yeah, I think it's important to keep the conversation open and going and sharing our traumatic experiences and the knowledge and expertise from individuals like yourself in the professional field can bring to the listeners, I feel is going to be invaluable to their pregnancy journey, their birthing experience, as well as the postpartum.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Just like taking some of that stigma away too, right? And just acknowledging that a lot of people go through really difficult things during this vulnerable time, and it's totally okay to talk about it. There's no shame and no one's here to judge.
And they're not alone.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much again, Dr. Carly King, for sharing your journey, your expertise, and your experience with us. As mentioned, we will provide resources in the description below for our listeners to reference if needed. We appreciate you taking the time to provide our listeners with information and resources that can assist with pregnancy, birth, and postpartum journeys.
And we'll be back next week with another amazing episode, so don't forget to mark the date on your busy mom's calendar.
Thanks for listening to my mommies, and I really love you so much.